All right. I'm back with another episode and another guest. Today, my guest is Julian Voss. Do I say Andre or Andre?
Both works.
Okay. There it is. All right. So, greetings. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Doing good. This is the best part of my day right here, interviewing awesome people from all over the world, artists, entertainers, chefs from the culinary field. This is the part I love. So, take me back. Where are you from?
I was born in Hamburg, Germany in
Okay.
1970. And then I grew up there. Then I moved to Berlin. I studied physics there, and then I went to, where did I go at that time? Oh yeah, then I went to Edinburgh for a year, and then I moved to Vienna, Austria, and then in 2000 I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I'm there since then.
Okay, the physics part, what got you into physics? Was that something you started out with young?
You're frozen. But I heard what got you into physics,
Yes,
so
what
I
got you
just
into
answered that.
physics? Yeah, you're frozen for some reason. I don't know why.
Okay, cool. When I was a kid, I read these like popular science articles with like Einstein sticking his tongue out and time and space being distorted, shit like that. And that was really cool. But then when a little bit later, when I was in Berlin, I studied a few courses in philosophy, and I came across a class in philosophy of science, and in that I delved into quantum physics, and I realized just that this is what quantum physics teaches us about the world is really crazy. And I felt at that point I can't just believe that from some popular science books. I have to actually do it myself. I have to go learn the math, do the physics, and go do the experiments myself, because that was like really earth-shattering to me, the
Okay.
insights.
Okay. So the experiments, tell me about those. What experiments were you doing?
So first of all, you have to learn for many, many years the tricks of the trade, which is like, you have to basically put all your creativity on the back burner and just bite the bullet and study, study, study for many years. But at the end of after 8 years of university, I ended up in this laboratory in Vienna where I was really fortunate to be part of a team that looked at the basically the transition between the normal world as we know it, classical physics, and the weirdness of quantum physics. So what we did is we took the at that point largest molecules ever and showed that they too show quantum behavior. They're like we're tiptoeing the line between the weird quantum and the real world as we know it, or what we think is real.
Okay. All right. I'm a person who's trying to get more into the physics, quantum physics, and theoretical physics, astrophysics, and everything like that. Slowly but surely trying to learn more and more about it because it's interesting to me, but I don't know the breakdown. So anytime I hear someone talk about it, I'm always tuned in and I try to get my mind into it and everything. So like you said, you had to put the fun part of it away, and you had to really just hone in on the craft of learning about the methods and the depth of it, because everything in its worth is basically math and science, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So in doing that, the creativity part, how long was it? Was it just that 8 years, or did you have to put it to the side for longer than that before you could get your creative side going?
Creativity is not just either you learn or you are creative. It's kind of when you learn, when you make stuff your own, knowledge that's out there, you need your creativity to phrase it in a way that your brain appreciates it, so that's another use of creativity, but it's not the standard, the normal how what we think about it, but it was painful, to force myself to kind of learn all that stuff. Interesting, because I took it as a challenge, but painful in the sense I had come at that point. I was an artist before that, so I'd done painting and drawing, and I missed that creative side, but I also loved the straight-lacement of it,
Okay.
that I could just be super. It's this right or wrong in math, which in the whole normal world you never see that. The real world is really messy, and math is simple in that way.
Interesting how you said that. Wow. That's a quote right there, man. I might have to use that later on once I understand a little bit more. All right. So your creative side, the artistry, did you grow up drawing? Was that something that was it music first, or was it art? What was it?
Well, music's a big deal in my family, but that
Okay.
was never really for me. I did a bunch of instruments, but I was always too lazy to like practice. And but my parents and my sister, they always do music. And so I loved Lego. That was my first thing. And then I did like electronics and chemistry, but also pottery and drawing. So I had like these artsy and sciencey hobbies. And I was super into computer programming when I was like 15 or so.
Oh, wow. So early on with the pro with computer programming and the science side of things.
Right.
Wow, that's awesome. That's pretty freaking awesome right there. So pottery, were you good? Was it pottery, just pottery, or was it painting, welding, sculpting?
Welding came much later. Welding came as a necessity after I done when I studied sculpture. I basically realized there's not many things that hold up against gravity that where you can go crazy in terms of the shape. And welding and steel is one of those technology, thanks to World War II mostly, that has developed so far that you can make crazy things. It's off the shelf technology,
Okay, because a lot of the okay, and speaking in that, looking at your sculptures, they're significantly different than some of the stuff I've ever seen. And you're combining the art world with the physics and everything. Was that something that you had seen someone else do, or did you come up with that idea all on your own?
Well, this you're talking about the segmented pieces that seem to
Yes.
disappear. That
Yes.
was actually it's an interesting story. So, I came up with it all by myself because my professor, who actually the guy who was running the group, the research group, I did this experiment. He won 2 years ago the Nobel Prize in Physics, and he made a joke which basically made me. It's stupid to explain, but it was like a total nerd like physics joke, and that story made me think about how would it be if I was the quantum object, the molecule we sent through this experiment. And so this visual of a walking man, consisting out of wavefronts as if it was a quantum object, that in 2006, I turned into this image of a walking man out of slices of steel that are parallel as if they are the wavefronts of the quantum object. So that was the start of this work. Later, much later, I discovered there was a guy in Turkey in 1986. So, 30 years before that, 20 years before I had that idea, who made a very similar piece, but he died shortly after. So there was one work just like that, actually, but I had known, I didn't know about that.
Okay, yeah, you're the first I've ever heard of to do it, and I was kind of just going through your page and seeing all this stuff. I was like, man, how the hell is he doing that? Like, and what made him decide to do that? So on average, when you're doing those sculptures, the planning and putting it together, how long does it take to do one of the sculptures?
Impossible to tell. I mean, it's the
Okay.
first ones, they took I the very first one I literally carved from an 8 foot tall block of styrofoam,
Wow.
and after I'd done the 3D carving, I then literally sliced it and trace the slices onto steel and then build it from that. And the second
Wow.
iteration, I basically took photos and then digitized it and laser cut the slices, and that it morphed over the years into, well, basically an approach that's more and more in the computer. So now I do basically everything in the computer with the exception of initial modeling, sometimes by hand, and 3D printing combining with hand modeling, and but lots of stuff in the computer, many different kind of like workflows and different software, and the tech and on the fabrication side, it used to be like plasma cut and MIG welded, and it was really crappy, and then it that morphed into like more and more like awesome, like super neat and clean welds, and like kind of the higher and higher standard to make it the more beautiful.
Okay, because looking at the work, it seems like it would be very meticulous to sit and do it hours
Totally, and
upon
it
hours.
took years to figure out that workflow, how to build that actually, because it's you can if you weld, it's a one-way street. You build and you can't clean up after yourself in after the fact. You have to clean up as you go and build it up.
Yeah, and that's what I
That's
was wondering is
the
like
trick.
that's what I was wondering, like how is he doing it? Because in welding, you have to go back and smooth it out and cut things down, the shards and everything like
Exactly.
that. You don't want to
Exactly.
be stuck with that. So I was wondering, how does he take his art to that level and it comes out so crisp and clean. So
Yeah.
now I'm getting a better
It
understanding of
took
that.
me from 2006 to 2014 to develop that workflow on the fabrication side. So now we're doing it basically essentially the same way we do it in 2014. So the last 10 years have not seen a whole lot of change there because now it's really like a dialed-in process.
Okay. Wow. I'm trying to wrap my mind around it because you're using a computer imagery to sculpt it for you, and then you're executing it live and in regular time.
Yeah, I mean, there's many steps in between. I mean, there's the 3D solid in the computer, but then I basically do these slices. But there's I take very imperfect starting as imperfect starting design. So the most of the work I spend actually is in the 2D stage where I turn, shitty lines essentially into beautiful curves. That's kind of like where I spend actually hundreds of hours in these pieces.
Okay, when you have to move these pieces around and take them to do exhibitions, is it easy to break them down, or do you have to like?
Nope. It's impossible to break them down
Okay.
because you cannot, you have to build them and that's it. So from a certain size on, it's you have to be very cognizant about how you transport them. No, but they have to be in one piece basically. Otherwise, it's a can of worms.
Jeez. Oh man, so it's basically just is what it is, and then you wrap it a certain way, or you box it up, and that's just the end of it.
That was also a huge learning curve. The first piece of one or two broke actually on the way during transport
Okay.
because every steel, if you vibrate it just long enough, it fatigues and then wears out. So I learned over time to basically what we do now is we have the pieces self-contained and they float in a bed of like styrofoam or whatever, like peanuts or something. So that's how it works the best. There's some exceptions like this astronaut I've just like published online. I can't transport him like this because it's made out of such thin steel that I have to build this custom crazy bed out of 24 plywood fins that are custom cut so it fits
Wow.
just exactly in. So the load is distributed over many, many points. So it doesn't not one point has all the load, and that would bend the steel.
I get what you're saying. My goodness, man, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work.
Yes.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around it because you're trying to transport this without having the steel, and certain parts get weaker or stronger than the other, and there's just too much tension on it, right? Is
Yeah,
that it? Okay. All
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
I'm just
Just
amazed. I'm just amazed at it, you know.
somebody picks you, you're lying on your belly, and somebody picks you up with a finger like this and punches. That would really hurt, right?
Yeah,
So, but if
definitely.
it's somebody cradles you with big hands, then it'd be wonderful to be
Right.
lifted.
It would be total distribution. It will hold the
Exactly.
whole body up. All right. So you moved to Portland. Is that correct?
Yeah, in 2000, I came here.
In 2000,
That's
you
where
moved to
I
Portland.
still am here. Yeah.
So what became your love for Portland? What made you want to stay in Portland?
The love of my wife for to my wife made me stay here. So I fell in love with her, and then that's how I didn't even know Portland. That was the only place where I ever moved to in America, So I came from Europe and then moved to Portland, and since then I'm here. So and
Okay.
we have now four kids, and we got married and all that stuff.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
A great woman, a good woman will do that to you, man.
Amazing. Yeah, she's
Yeah,
really
man.
amazing.
Yeah, salute to you and the wife and the kids, man. That's an awesome thing to have. Are your kids artists?
Some of
Some
them.
of them. Okay.
Yeah,
Okay.
one especially.
Do they follow out the dead, or are they doing something totally different?
No, I think they want to do something totally different. My
Okay.
oldest is actually a computer scientist now.
Oh,
And the
that's
second
neat.
one is a psychologist, studies psychology. But the third one is, I think she's going to be an artist one day, but she doesn't know that yet, probably. But she probably has no choice. And then the fourth one, I don't know yet.
When you're doing your sculpting and you're creating, is it just you? Does anyone get to see the trade secrets, see behind the curtain, or is it just you?
I'm in my workflow. I'm on my computers, and that's nobody really messes with that. That's by myself.
Okay, because I'm still
Whereas
I'm
all the fabrication stuff, that's teamwork. The
okay.
design is me. And then when the parts come in the shop, then it's a huge team. I mean, huge, like six people, six to 10 people.
And how big are the sculptures? How tall are they?
Well, the small ones are maybe 2 feet, and then many are like 6 to 8 feet or so. And after 10, 12 feet, 6,000 pounds, it gets a little problematic with what you can ship.
Six
So
thousand
it's somewhere
pounds.
there. So six. Yeah. So we've done a public piece for Columbus, Ohio. That was 6,000 pounds and 10 feet can do. I made a piece for Florida that was 12 feet tall, actually. And that was a pain to ship all the way from Portland to Florida. I had to find like a guy who would usually drive boats from one coast to the other because they have really low trailers. So I could get high enough with getting through the bridges, you know.
Wow.
But that was at a point where I didn't know what I was doing. It was in the beginning, so now I know these things.
Yeah, of course, trial and error, you have to go through the process of learning.
Exactly. Exactly.
Have you ever lost, how many sculptures have you lost in transportation? Do you know?
I remember one that was broken because FedEx was kicking the box. I don't know what they did with it. I had a damage in the old days. I mean, it's rare, you know. It's like maybe once in 2 years or so, in 3 years, maybe that happens. It's always a huge pain, and then we have to kind of fix it or get make a new one. But it's what it is. It's just part of doing something in 3D physics. It's just real, you know, real stuff that can
And
break.
it's amazing work. It's amazing work. I love it. I marvel at it when I'm watching it and I'm
Thank
looking at
you.
the things, the sculptures that you're creating. Did you know that it would take off and become such a great work?
No, I started out making physics, making protein structures, and I at that point I was like dreaming. I was dreaming like that people always. I thought there's so many proteins and I could make so many and people that would be a thing. I made a few actually, also some public pieces for universities and stuff, but it never took off in the same way the sliced pieces took off. I didn't really actually think that at all. I didn't even think I could make a living wage as an artist. I didn't think that really.
And I really think that's the best thing that you, for what I understand about doing what you love, it just takes that to just do something that you love, and the universe, God, will just reward you because of that, because you just love doing what you have chosen to do.
Yeah.
And I think that, to me, that's it's a beautiful thing when people just take the time to do the art or the cooking or the music that they love, and they just put this, they just pour their all into that, and it shows. It shows in the end, whether it's monetarily gained or however you're rewarded in life. I think it's a beautiful thing.
It is totally amazing, and I feel extremely blessed that I get to do this. But on the other hand, I've seen a whole lot of people who are super talented, but maybe they're missing certain things, even if it's only luck, and they don't make it. And so it seems pretty unfair overall. But if you're able to really find your voice and sing that tune you want to sing, that's really cool as a human being. That's wonderful.
When you see certain artists who are missing things, do you ever let them in on a secret or tell them how they should do it?
I'm asked. I offer whatever advice I can, always. It's just the truth is, it's so complicated. You know, many artists I was one of those too. I when I was young, when I was painting and drawing, and people would ask me sometimes to buy a picture from me, and I would go like, "No, I'm not going to sell it," because I felt the money is tainting it and makes it wrong, and so I would give it away. And I was like super unable to basically. But to be business minded. Now I'm different. You know, I feel it's really important, especially when you do sculptures, you have so many expenses. You have to keep the ship afloat. You know, you have to tap into that market aspect. And I don't feel it's a bad thing because it's also a connecting to your audience. You know, you're not in a vacuum as a human being. You're never in a vacuum. You always connect to the others. So you might as well connect consciously also to the people who, you know, buy your work. And I think that's totally fine, you know, if you don't sell your integrity.
And I like that you said that that's the biggest part, the respect and integrity of it all. Those are contributing and key factors to me in anything that you do, having respect and integrity. Selling a picture, selling a painting, selling a sculpture is fine. But as long as you're just not, as long as you're not just doing it because of that, just because money is attached, it's also important to always love it and have some integrity and respect for what it is that you do. Whether it
Exactly.
be like whether it be music or cooking or anything else that I've said previously. So
Yeah.
it's a beautiful thing. In the artist community, Do you do like mentor work with some of the other artists?
No, I'm not really, a community person. I'm not,
Oh.
I'm not very social either. I've my now I found ways to actually tap into the community in other ways, but not in art. I'm involved with the Portland Psychedelic Society, and that's really work that's close to my heart, policy work, and exploring how plant medicines can become more of a cultural mainstream thing. But that's totally outside the art world.
Talk to me about that. How did you get into that?
I felt called to do ayahuasca when I was about 50, about 3, 4 years ago, and that changed my life pretty drastically. And I've seen, firsthand, A, the healing power, and B, the heat not for not only for yourself but also for society as one, but also the miracle of when you visit indigenous communities that have been doing this for thousands of years, you come from this materialist reductionist paradigm, like the Western paradigm, and you get exposed to the miracle that there is so much more than what you are able to capture within your paradigm, where you come from, where your lineage comes from. That really humbles you, and it makes you wonder what the hell is going on, what else have I missed?
Yeah.
So I'm
Okay.
excited about that because it has this potential to really break the paradigm and open doors.
I've never done ayahuasca, but I was told by a person who did it. He said, man, it's like an ego death. It's like whatever you really thought of yourself, however high on a horse that you were, it'll break through all of that and it'll bring you down to earth and it'll give you some realizations about yourself. And I was like, man, one day I got to try it. He said, yeah, you just got to go to South America or something like that. He would go with me or whatever. But I've heard really good things about it, but I've never been a guy that's been driven off of ego or pride. I'm a person that knows that if I'm able to do something or I'm capable of doing it, then I'm just good at that, and I don't have to boast and brag about it. But one of the things that he was saying also, man, he's like, you come away with a lot more clarity, and you learn to walk away from things that you think matter more than they actually do. He says it's like it's like having a different epiphany on like a higher level or something like that.
Right, exactly.
Now, the healing properties of it, explain that to me.
Well, I mean, what I've ex it's it seems almost like as if when you take these plant medicines, that in New Age language you would say it raises your vibration, whatever that exactly means, but somehow it makes your body and your being operate on a level where everything that doesn't fit in there feels wrong. Like you lie to yourself, you have trauma, you've done something wrong. All that stuff suddenly shows up. It's like a like dirt that comes out of a wound. And suddenly you go like, oh, that itches. I want to get rid of that. Usually you incorporate that into your life and you use your trauma. If you look at politicians, they're driven by trauma. They are power hungry and you wonder why are they such jerks? But they have been hurt as kids, or whatever happened. And that's it comes out in these twisted ways. And it when you go undergo these kind of ceremonies, you become aware of that. And you have the natural wish to kind of not have this be part of you so much, and you're able to sort of see it from a higher vantage point. It's really hard to explain, but that's how it feels like to me. And
So it's like
that's where the healing comes in.
so it's kind of like a purge of your system.
Yeah, it's that's part of it, Yeah. And it's also your pains and your physical kind of frailties or like your problems, they become, you see them sort of, you tend to see them as manifestations of something deeper underlying,
So
And
this potentially has the properties to help with people who are maybe dealing with depression or stress.
absolutely. Depression is a famous one. Anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, even, OCD, eating disorders. Those things are prime candidates that respond well to those type of psychedelic treatments. Yes.
And in Portland, where you are, how far along are you to getting these put into regulated use?
So we had two measures here in Oregon. One is measure 110, the other one is measure 109. 110 was to decriminalize, certain drugs, and that got repealed just now. But 109 is still an act, it's still active, which allows this, the so-called Oregon model, where people train to become mushroom psilocybin facilitators, and they learn how to give mushrooms to people and sit with them and be with there with their journey in the beginning to prepare them during the journey and afterwards, what's called integration. So there's this whole clinical setup where it's legally allowed to do this, and people come from all over the place into Portland and to Oregon to undergo these. It's really interesting, and I'm actually learning to do this myself to become a mushroom facilitator or to at least go through the schooling because it's fascinating to me.
Okay. Question about that, using psilocybin and mushrooms. Is it possible, and I'm just asking because we're talking, is it possible for someone who was addicted to a drug like heroin to use that and get them off, to wean them off of it?
There's plenty of evidence that this has been tried and shown in clinical trials that it's very, very potent. It's one of the most potent things to get people off hard drugs like this.
Okay.
I mean, look at the work of Gabor Maté in Canada, for example. He went with people to the jungle, and then they never touched heroin again, many of them, like hardcore drugs, you know.
I haven't heard of that. I haven't heard of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch of research now, and it's very powerful. I stopped drinking alcohol 4 years ago, basically, you know, altogether. I just don't drink anymore.
No drinking at all.
Nope.
Here and there, I have a beer or some wine. I'm not a big drinker, though. I'll go out if I'm in a social setting, or I'm visiting a bar and I want to watch the games. I'll have some beer or some wine.
Yeah.
But I don't indulge too much because of the way it makes me feel, and I can feel my body going, "No, we've had enough of this right here."
But that's awesome that you're aware like this, you know. Most many people are not. Like, I would not be able to stop really after two or so beers, you know. That'd be really difficult for me, and it runs in my German lineage, you know. We're not doing well with alcohol. it's
Okay.
it's it's a it's a it's a problem.
Yeah, for me, it's like that second drink or that third drink. My body starts to go, "All right, you've had enough of this stuff, put some water in it, and we pack it up. Like, we got to figure out something else." So
That's great. Yeah.
now cannabis, I would definitely prefer cannabis because, I get clarity. I'm able to use my creative side a lot better, or it allows me the peace to calm down and be more introspective when I'm alone. So I'm definitely more aware and more of a believer in the helps of cannabis. I've also seen how cannabis has been able to help people who were addicted to hard drugs. I've seen people who were able to wean themselves off of heroin by using certain indicas because they're so strong, and it's changed their life. And they went from being doped out and hurt to being functioning citizens in society. So it's beautiful to see that you can use these plants or these mushrooms or ayahuasca, and they could help change people's lives. And I believe that there should be more attention paid to that. And maybe they are doing it. They're just trying to figure a way to regulate it so that they can, of course, capitalize on it. But the science of it all and the humanity of it all is something that I really do think that should be looked into more and more everywhere.
Yeah, I know there's huge potential. I mean, the problem is that since 1970 or so, Nixon administration declared the war on drugs, which was kind of a thinly veiled, you know, ra racist kind of thing, basically. And so that's why we're still suffering from this, you know. And this only, if you look at the history, it's really interesting how psychedelics have been suppressed. I mean, just look at the early Christianity, you know, the first 150 to 300 years, when Christianity became from a psychedelic sect, it went into a state religion within 300 years or so. And during that time, the psychedelics went out the window and became a power game, essentially.
It did, and it's crazy. And I'm glad that you said that, because here you're talking about a bunch of guys who were sitting around doing drugs, writing scriptures, and coming up with plays and all type of stuff. And it went from that to let's become driven by power and control and things of that nature. So
Absolutely.
it's crazy how that the what you call it, the Council of Constantinople and all these different things that they had, so they could come into control the Council of Nicaea and everything like that. So
Yeah.
it's crazy how these things took place and how they turned around the history. Even what you said about the administrations, Nixon and those guys, calling it marijuana when it was just a plant. Like it's been here for 9, 10, 11,000 years, and now they're trying to all of a sudden make it seem like, oh yeah, it's good now, but it was always good. There was never anything wrong with the plant.
Exactly, exactly.
You've seen people use hemp for clothes, for shoes, not just for smoking. You know, there were so many available resources using hemp. You could also use it. At one point, they were using it to wrap mummies. You know, and they act like these were things that had never been done. So I'm all for it. I'm with you guys on that, man. Any way I can be of support and talk about it, or share, or post a video or anything that could help, you know, let me know. I would definitely like to do that. Definitely. So back to your art, because I'm still curious about all this art you have going on. The way that you're doing it now, do you have another technique that you're working on, or is this just this is the final method?
Well, I mean, I'm always interested in trying out stuff, but it's always tricky, A, there's not so many cool ways of doing things, and B, there's also like with success comes like the fact that you are suddenly busy, all the time with doing stuff along the same line. So it kind of it's a natural way of filtering out, innovation. So this is an effect that's real, and so I have to be mindful about that actually.
Going back to drinking, I have a question about that. Did you feel that the drinking made you slower and it took away from your productivity and creativity?
Sorry, could you repeat that? You were just frozen for a second there.
Okay. Going back to the drinking, did you feel that it took away from your creativity and productivity?
No, not really. In fact, in my youth, I actually remembered creating a piece where I drank wine and alternating wine and coffee throughout the night, and it was a very powerful kind of flow. But so for me, I'm sort of in my neighborhood. When I was a kid, there was an artist in my neighborhood. My father made a movie about him, and he was like a really pretty well-known guy in Germany, and he was like an amazing kind of a genius, and he was a total alcoholic. So since my youth, I always connected alcoholism and alcohol with creativity. So that was always totally like a okay combo, Almost the intoxication was the artistic, the creative flow, So, so I never felt it as negative for that actually. But it did, mess up my life. I feel, alcohol never really did anything that I did a lot of things where I was embarrassed about, and that's and I trying to live in integrity that just doesn't fit in there.
So you said that it had to go. The drinking had to go.
Yeah, de definitely at that point, and for now, I mean it's just not for me at this time in my life. Man, sorry, my people are really loud in the kitchen. I hope that doesn't.
No, I don't hear. I don't hear. We
Okay,
good.
cool.
You're good. You're good. So, on this journey now, where you are, do you have any upcoming shows?
I these days I there's well actually we there's art fairs. There'll be a new piece that'll be at Art Miami in November, end of November, beginning December, and so that's I'm excited about that. I'll probably go there myself. But a show we're working on one, oh yeah, with my gallery in Palm Desert actually. We're gonna have a show in spring, I think. I have to actually think about that. And then I've one is planned for a museum, but that's not materialized yet. So that's something that's in the longer term picture. I'm working towards that.
Okay. What would you like for people to take away from your art when they view it?
I don't know. I mean, just like if people find, a moment of childlike wonder, that's huge,
They're really awesome sculptures, man. I can't say that enough. I'm really taken back by them. Like, I really enjoy looking at the sculptures. I'm really inspired by them too.
For me, it's also,
It
thank you.
gets
I
my it gets
appreciate
my it
that.
gets my 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 art my artistic side going when I'm looking at it. So, but go
I
ahead.
mean, the wonder and the beauty is for me like a is really awesome and important for what I love to do. But I think it's also now that this question make me think a little bit. When I do a lot of it's almost all bodies, human bodies, right? So it has a lot to do with what's beneath the surface. You see this body, you take the life you have for granted, but what's behind it, you know, the amazing energy, you know, that we have this material body, but there's this energy being at the bottom of it, you know, it's like as if the physical body is a manifestation of a deeper, energetic, much huger being, you know, and it's this much bigger underlying being I want to hint at, you know, it's ephemeral, it's not material, you know,
Because
it's
that's what I feel
energetic.
like. Yeah, that's what I feel like when I'm looking at it. I feel like the person is being stripped away and you're actually just looking at the spirit or the soul of a person,
Yeah,
you know, and you get to
exactly.
look through it and see the ins and out of the person and who they are. It's just like if me and you were to meet in person, instead of you seeing this, you would see the light within and you would be able to see who I really am when I look at this
Exactly.
picture.
It's sort of a metaphor for that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So I'm glad you said that. I was like, this is how I feel about it when I'm looking at this. All right.
Oh, see, I did my job. Good.
Yes, you did. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really enjoy it. My next question, I want to go back to the using ayahuasca. Is this something that you use often?
No, you know, it's exhausting. It's not like
Okay.
fun. You know, it's like a I do it when I prepare myself. It's a big deal in
Okay.
many respects, you know. So I do journey. I have done at this point 12 ayahuasca ceremonies and several with mushrooms and when I do it, I do it very consciously and it's a big deal and it's exhausting too.
So when you say you've done 12 so far, is that like once a year, once every couple years? How does it go?
It's typically like if you go to a retreat, you do three or four in a row, which is really powerful.
Jeez.
Like you do it a week and then every other night, for example, you know,
And why is it so
go
many?
several nights.
Can you explain why there are so many?
It's just powerful. It's one is great, but if you do more, it opens you more, you know, it's much more powerful. I don't know why.
Okay, and where do you do your is it, do you go to South America as well?
I've done that, yes. I
Okay.
went to Costa Rica and I did it with a tribe called the Achua in what's called Ecuador, the country of Ecuador, at the Peruvian border in the
Okay.
jungle.
All right. So I have enjoyed this interview. Highlight of my day. You know, I'm appreciative to have you here. Is there anything, any message you would like to leave before we get off?
No, I appreciate your wonderful questions and it was a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, sir. It was a pleasure talking to you as well, Julian. I really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of Faux Prophets Podcast. My guest is Julian Voss Andre. And remember the mission statement when you're striving for greatness. God never puts you in the driver's seat if it's taken. Julian, thank you once again. Have a great night, sir.
You, sir. You too.